Live from Southern California, this is the Jim Rome Show.
I've said it before, I'll say it again right now. The NBA offseason is better than every other sports regular season. Because at this point, I'm not even sure there is an NBA offseason. Like the Toronto Raptors, they had the NBA headlines for all of 24 hours. They hadn't even had their championship parade. The champagne had not even dried. That guy with the house plant was still, in fact, a story.
Plant guy. Plant guy. What's with the plant, man? Where'd you get that?
It's a housewarming gift for Kawhi.
Oh, I see.
He's staying.
Does he know this yet?
I'm waiting. Have you seen him?
I haven't seen him yet. I think he's somewhere in Oakland right now, celebrating his butt off.
Well, when you see him, tell him I got a housewarming gift. Tell him I love him.
I will. What kind of plant is that?
Tell him thank you for the shot.
What kind of plant is that?
It's a plant for Kawhi. It's a Kawhi plant.
It's a Kawhi plant.
It's a Kawhi cactus.
Have a good night, man.
Cactus.
Cactus. I like to collect it.
All right, so that goofball is probably still marching around the six with that cactus. When Woj dropped a Woj bomb for the ages on Saturday. The Pelicans had agreed to a deal to send Anthony Davis to the LA Lakers for a package of players and draft picks. I mean, holy crap. Huge, right? Really, really big. Alvin, fire up some Randy Newman. Why not? Car Flag Nation, mount up! LeBron James and Anthony Davis in Los Angeles. LeBron and AD in the purple and gold. I mean, that is huge. Huge because Davis gets what he wants. The Lakers get what they needed. No, check that. The Lakers got what they absolutely had to have. The Lakers had to do that. And they were going to pay pretty much whatever New Orleans asked for in order to get that deal done. Because they had no choice. And the reason they had no choice is because that organization had become the laughing stock of the entire NBA. An abject embarrassment. They were funny, man. I don't think that I need to remind anyone that their president quit. He quit his gig so he could tweet. And then he accused the GM and Rob Lowe lookalike of being a backstabber. And he had one report of terrible management and chaos after another. And then the wife of a former player, pretty much being everything from the shadow GM to the shadow CEO to the shadow owner to the shadow power forward. And that's not to say that those things aren't still issues, because you know they are. But they seem a hell of a lot smaller when you bring in a 6'10" power forward who is one of the most unstoppable players in the league in the prime of his career. And unlike every other star who might be available, this guy actually wants to be there. And then on top of that, you get to pair him with LeBron James. So how big is that? Saturday night is an example. The trending topics on Twitter were Lakers, Pelicans, Lonzo, Kemba, Zion, Ingram, Anthony Davis, Kuzma, Braun, and Hart. The Lakers had not played a game since April, and yet they were dominating sports yet again. How big? How big? This big. Magic Johnson tweeted the following. Great trade, Rob Pelinka. Job well done. My man actually thumbed that out. I mean, holy crap. You know it's big when Magic is actually name-checking this guy. When Traj is actually mentioning Rob by name and giving him credit for something and not blaming him or plunging a steak knife into his back. This is what I've said all along. As dysfunctional as the Lakers could be, and really they couldn't be any more dysfunctional than they were or are, but if they make one trade, and it's the right trade, it could potentially change everything in an instant. Especially after Kevin Durant went down and Klay Thompson went down, both with major injuries, and the two of them could miss all of next season. Suddenly, the West is wide open again. Now, don't get it twisted. The Lakers did give up a lot. They gave up a lot. Just don't confuse a lot with too much. And given that Davis has 1 year left on his deal, and almost everybody would have been looking at him as a one-year rental, the Pelicans worked a hell of a deal to get what they got. Again, reportedly, Lonzo Ball, Brandon Ingram, Josh Hart, and the following picks. although this has changed a couple of times. But it looks like the picks are like this. The number four pick in this year's draft. A protected pick in 2021 that becomes unprotected in 22. An unprotected swap in 23. And an unprotected first-round pick in 24 that can be deferred to 25. So, after the dust from that bomb settled, there were two questions. Are the Lakers maybe the favorites in the West? Or did the Lakers give up too much? And the fact is, the second question answers the first. Of course they gave up a lot. You have to give up a lot to get an MVP candidate and one of the best players in the league and a future Hall of Famer. You're not going to get a guy like that for pennies on the dollar. But did they give up too much? Are you serious about that? For a team that has not finished above 500 in 6 years. If you're a team that has missed the playoffs every year for 6 years running, and you're the Lakers, and now you're regarded as a legitimate threat, there is no such thing as giving up too much. I mean, sure, Davis could get hurt, or LeBron could get hurt, or they could both get hurt. But if that's a justification for not making that trade, then it's a justification for never making any trade. So if you're saying they gave up too much, you either really, really love those young Lakers or you really, really hate the Lakers because that's legitimately a terrible take. Too much. How is it too much? Lonzo Ball can see a lot of court, but he's rarely healthy enough to be on the court. 3 years into Brandon Ingram's career, he's not exactly the second coming of Kevin Durant the Laker fans were so hyped about. And Josh Hart is a really nice piece. But he averages less than 8 points and 4 rebounds a game. So for all their potential, those guys were not leading to a bunch of wins. Anthony Davis does. Again, we're talking about Anthony Davis, a guy who was averaging 26, 12, and 4 this year. In a year that was really weird. The guy averaged 28 and 11, 28 and 12 the previous 2 years. And he's 26. As good as this guy's been, he might not have even reached his prime yet. And he's certainly never played with anybody as good as LeBron James. I could even argue that LeBron has never played with anybody as good as AD. So, are you really going to sweat a pick swap in 2025 over that? Again, do I have to remind you, the Lakers missed the playoffs 6 years in a row. Barring injuries, this year, that streak is over. And not only is it over, they may be a legitimate threat in the West. Golden State's got issues. The West is wide open. I'll give you this. There is a big difference between being a possible contender in June of 2019 and being an actual contender in June of 2020. And it is contingent upon the official timing of this trade and what it means to the salary cap and the rest of the moves they can make this summer. Can they squeeze out the space for a run at a max guy like Kemba? Or do they split that money up and try to get shooters and depth? Regardless, they now have two of the top 7 guys in the league. They've got something to build on. You got to give up something to get something. And speaking of giving up something, just because Davis ended up in L.A. does not mean that Pelicans' genius, David Griffin, didn't do his job. He did. This guy worked an amazing deal because he did get 3 young players and a bunch of draft picks. Not only did he get a bunch of draft picks, but he's betting on those draft picks becoming increasingly valuable after LeBron ages out or retires. Smart. Lakers, what can I say? Last year, they tripped all over themselves and somehow ended up with LeBron James. This year, they puke all over themselves and yet somehow end up with Anthony Davis. Must be nice. Somehow, someway, they manage to fall forward, fail forward. And while I can't guarantee that it's going to work, at least they've given themselves a chance. That's a move they had to make. Had to make. And now I cannot wait to see what Linda Rambis has up her sleeve. Rob Lowe. Rob Pelinka. Or whoever the hell is calling the shots there. I like it. I like it for both. Hey, listen. Summertime is the very best time. Except for one thing. The bugs, flies, insects invading your home, attacking you. Man, I hate that. Which is why I love and I want to thank our sponsors over at Dynatrap. Dynatrap is the leading manufacturer of outdoor mosquito and insect traps. And now they have come up with a solution for indoor pests. The Dynatrap Fly Light works day and night to attract and trap flies, fruit flies, mosquitoes, other pesky insects. I'm telling you, it works. It's summertime. We leave our windows open. There are flies and bugs everywhere. That's why I love the Dynatrap Fly Light. Another reason I love it is because I hate those disgusting fly strips. Trust me on this. Get yours at Dynatrap.com, Dynatrap.com. Enter the promo code Rome. Get 15% off any of their products. Dynatrap, the safe, silent, and simple solution to household insect control. Chris Mannix is my guest. Chris, great to have you. Thanks so much. How are you?
I'm good, Jim. How are you doing?
Good, bud. Good. Got to get your initial reaction. When the Anthony Davis trade was reported on Saturday, what was the first thing that went through your mind?
Well, I guess I'd want to hear what the Pelicans got out of it. I had been writing for a while now that Anthony Davis to basketball was the equivalent of Herschel Walker to football. Like, it needed to be and would be the biggest and most significant trade in NBA history. And as things started to leak out, specifically when it came to the draft considerations, you could see that it was that. I mean, the Pelicans, with the control they have over the Lakers picks, at least through 2024, if not longer, that's significant right there. And look, the Lakers, they had to do this deal, Jim, because they put themselves on the LeBron James timeline, but they gave up a lot, and the Pelicans have a good chance of rebuilding this thing into a sustainable winner very quickly.
Chris Mannix joining us. I agree with you, Chris. They had to. I mean, they had no choice. They had to do that. I also agree they did give up a lot. In your opinion, did they give up too much?
I mean, look, we can Monday morning quarterback it for sure. The Lakers, they had to know that the field, you know, they were competing with wasn't all that significant. I mean, Boston was out there, but the Kyrie Irving situation had the Celtics pulling their punches when it came to making an offer to the Pelicans. Certainly, recent history has shown that a team we're not talking about in the same way that Oklahoma City was with Paul George and Toronto was with Kawhi Leonard could have emerged, but the Lakers had to have this guy. I mean, they did. And look, we'll see what happens in 2023 when LeBron's in his very late 30s, if he's playing for the Lakers at all. They'll hope that Anthony Davis's body holds up over the next 5 or 6 years of his next contract. But, again, it comes down to they had to make this deal. They had to get this guy, and now it's all about building around him.
We are talking to Chris Mannix. All right, so what about that? What about fit? How do you see LeBron and Davis working together on the floor?
Oh, I think they're a great fit stylistically. I mean, you've got two guys that are extremely versatile offensively. Davis in the last 2 years has really developed his offensive game to include the three-point shot. Now, this year, his numbers dipped a little bit, but this was a very strange year from start to finish. So I think you could toss those out. So he's right around a 34, 35% three-point shooter, a number that, you know, when you talk to the coaches in New Orleans over the years, they figure is only going to improve. So you not only have a guy that is lethal off the dribble against, you know, bigger and more plodding centers, but now he can step out, be a floor spacer, and that's just what LeBron needs. You know, he didn't have it last year in Los Angeles. Davis provides that type of option. And look, defensively, Davis can swing between two positions. He can play kind of a quasi-small ball front court with LeBron at the four. I just think the Lakers are going to be able to trot out a bunch of different lineups that are effective in different ways.
Chris Mannix joining us. And then, Chris, they were able to hold on to Kyle Kuzma. So what about that fit of LeBron, AD, and Kuzma in the front court? Does that work for you?
I think it works. You know, defensively, they're going to have to figure some things out. But when you have a guy like Kuzma that can step in and play multiple positions at times last year, he was kind of a small ball center for the Lakers with that group. I think they've got a chance to be really dynamic offensively, but it all comes down to, Jim, how they fill this roster out. I mean, we saw with the Toronto Raptors, they had their superstar in Kawhi Leonard. They had a second star in Kyle Lowry, but they are champions because they identified Pascal Siakam and they picked up Fred VanVleet off the scrap heap and they made a deal for Marc Gasol at midseason. This is where Rob Pelinka's hard work comes in. It was easy, but you know, he gave up the store to go get Anthony Davis, and that's the easier part of this deal. The second part of building a contender is going to be using second-round picks, free agent acquisitions, small deals. He's got to find a way to build the roster out around these two players.
So bottom line that for me, Chris, is the move to spread the money around and try to collect shooters in depth, or do you try to take that big swing and go after somebody like Kemba Walker?
First, I don't think they're going to have the cap space to make a move on Kemba unless they make another deal to free some space. I mean, you probably talked about the logistics of it. If it happens on July 30th, maybe they have the cap space. But the Pelicans have no reason to help the Lakers with anything anymore. I mean, they are in the business now of the Lakers being bad. So I think they're going to execute this deal on July 26th or July 6th, and that's going to limit the cap space even more. I would spread it out. I would look at guys like J.J. Redick. I would look at a restricted free agent like Malcolm Brogdon. I would look for shooters out there to surround with these guys. I mean, last year was a joke. I mean, the players they put around LeBron, it never made any sense. You know, follow the blueprint that Miami created and that Cleveland took to another level. Put shooters around this guy. Put shooters around Anthony Davis. Force one-on-one defenses. And watch this team shine offensively. I think that's got to be Rob Pelinka's priority.
We are talking to Chris Mannix. Listen, I hear exactly what you're saying. You need to see more. You need to see what they do and who they surround these two guys with. But given the move and given the situation that the Warriors find themselves in right now, I mean, is it too soon to say, or where would you rank the Lakers among contenders in the West?
I'd put them in the middle of the pack right now until we see what it is they do next. Chemistry and continuity is key. I mean, the Rockets, I mean, they're kind of dysfunctional right now, but on paper, I would think the Rockets are the favorite to come out of the West. I mean, they've been to, you know, close to the mountaintop before. Unless they make a deal, most of their guys are coming back. I mean, they're a really good team, and if they can figure this Mike D'Antoni stuff out, I think they've got a chance to be the heir to Golden State. I think Denver's only going to get better. I think Portland's got a chance with Nurkic coming back to get better. I think the Lakers, while they have the foundation for a really good team, I'm just going to wait and see see what pieces they add around these two players before I crown them favorites in the West.
And you mentioned, Chris, that they've got to figure out this Mike D'Antoni stuff. ESPN's got a report right now that there might be some internal issues with the Rockets. Do they also, in your opinion, have to figure out some Chris Paul stuff too?
You do, and it's more internal, but I don't know what the market is for Chris Paul. I mean, when they signed him to that contract, that's going to pay him like $40 million or whatever it is on the back end of that deal when he's in his late 30s. They knew they were kind of making their deal with the devil, so to speak. Like this was, they were paying for two, maybe three high-level years of Chris Paul and then dealing with whatever comes afterwards. So I don't know what the market is for Chris Paul at that kind of contract number and at this stage of his career. If there really is friction between Chris and James Harden, they've got to deal with that internally. And I think it starts with, you know, getting Mike D'Antoni on board for multiple years. He doesn't have a staff right now, Jim. And there's no coach that has other options that is going to join with Mike D'Antoni, who is effectively a lame duck. You're going to have to go with kind of retreads and guys that don't have any other options that are out there, who might take a one-year deal to work on D'Antoni's staff. So if I'm the Rockets, everything I'm doing to improve begins with the internal stuff.
We are talking to Chris Mannix. All right, Chris, back to Lakers for a minute. What is the fact that Anthony Davis is going to Los Angeles say about Rich Paul?
Well, he's effective. He just is. I mean, it goes back to some of the other things he's done with the Cavaliers and the guys he had on that roster with Eric Bledsoe when he wanted him to get out of Phoenix. It's a bit, I'm not sure what the word is, but it's unseemly to a degree how they handled the Davis stuff, because they effectively sabotaged what was left of the Pelican season. But, you know, at the end of the day, he's where he wanted to be. And he's where Anthony Davis claimed to want to be. So I think the ends justify the means when it comes to Rich Paul. Now, I do think that there's a lot of power he wields within the organization, especially when it comes to how the coaching staff shakes out. And certainly, you know, as you fill out the roster, don't be surprised to see another Rich Paul client wind up there. But that's not unusual. Like, agents have wielded power in organizations before. David Falk did it when he had Michael Jordan and Patrick Ewing. Dan Fagan did it with a couple of different organizations in his time as an agent. It's not strange to see agents have this kind of influence. What Rich Paul is doing, though, is doing it in a little bit of an unorthodox way.
We are talking to Chris Mannix. All right, so everybody had a few moments to think about this deal now, and he goes to the Lakers. The focus then shifted back to the Celtics. Boston was thought to be the team that might have an even better package for him. What happened with Boston?
Well, they know Kyrie's gone, and because of that, they're not willing to mortgage their future on the chance that Anthony Davis signs up with them long term. The deal they made with Kyrie a couple of years ago, it didn't really cost them much. I mean, it cost them Isaiah Thomas, who was coming off an all NBA season, but Isaiah barely played for the Cavaliers and hasn't been the same player since because of that hip. It cost them a lottery pick, but it didn't turn out to be the top three pick the Cavs thought they were getting. Instead, it was eight, which turned into Colin Sexton. So the Celtics, you know, when Irving eventually walks in a couple of weeks, it's not like they lost a ton on that particular deal. If they traded for Davis, they would have. They would have had to trade a Jason Tatum. They would have had to include most or all of their draft picks. And I don't blame the Celtics or Danny Ainge for not wanting to go all in on that situation. The Celtics, even though they're getting kind of pilloried right now for everything sort of not working out, which is a little bit strange to me, seeing how much people are jumping on them, they're still a really good team. I mean, the core of this team that went to a conference finals just last year is intact. And Terry Rozier has to be rehabilitated to a degree, but he can come back. He's a restricted free agent. They'll add Gordon Hayward, who's only going to be better next year, a year removed from his first season after the injury. He's going to be better. I think the Celtics are still a top four team in the Eastern Conference. And with the teams that are above them facing so many problems, I mean, Toronto, they could lose Kawhi. Philly has two huge free agents in Harrison Butler. The Bucks have Chris Middleton and Malcolm Brogdon, not to mention Brooke Lopez and some other ancillary pieces. I don't know that the Celtics are out of this yet. Plus, I think they're going to make another move because they don't want to use all their draft picks. I think they'll flesh out the roster with somebody before the start of the season.
We are talking to Chris Mannix, and we'll do so for a few more moments. So, Chris, meanwhile, when all of this is going on, the Raptors were having their parade, and as you and I talked about earlier this season, the Clippers had been shadowing Kawhi Leonard pretty much all season long. How much does winning a title in Toronto impact Kawhi's decision?
You know, it's a great question, and I wish I had the answer. I don't think anybody really knows.
Right.
I mean, I think that a lot of people around the league, including the Clippers, believe they're the favorite to land him. They have been doing that kind of shadow recruiting. But Kawhi is his own man and has a very, very small inner circle. And one thing the Raptors, some of their executives told me over the last few weeks, was that they hope that moments influence Kawhi Leonard. And moments are like what we saw in Game 7 against Philly, where he knocks down that shot on the Toronto home floor. Moments like winning the conference finals in Toronto. Moments like winning a championship. I'm skeptical that Kawhi would ever lock himself up to a five-year deal with the Toronto Raptors. But if he was going to go back to Toronto, a short-term deal may be possible. I still think the Clippers are the team that is in the pole position here. But going back to Toronto on a short-term deal where you maximize whatever's left of Kyle Lowry, whatever's left of Marc Gasol, and give Masai Ujiri a chance to add even more talent to the roster, I think that's plausible. I think the Raptors are in a tough spot, but I think it's possible.
And then finally, what about Golden State? What do they look like next year?
I think they look like Steph Curry and whoever else can get to play for him. I don't think Durant's back. I think he's still going to wind up on one of the New York teams. But even if he was, he's not playing next year. Klay Thompson probably won't be back until March, and they may elect to just punt on the season for Klay as well, just to protect him for 2020. The big question I think the Warriors have to answer next year is, what do you do with Draymond Green? I mean, Draymond Green, the heart and soul of that team, no question, but he's somebody that is going to be a free agent in 2020. And if he is, do you really want to max him out in 2020? Or do you look to deal him and get 60-75% on the dollar for guys that could be part of what you do long-term with Steph and Klay? I think that's going to be a decision that Bob Myers, Joe Lacob, Met front office really have to think about.
He is an NBA writer for Sports Illustrated, an NBA analyst for NBC Sports Boston, a boxing analyst for DAZN, and host of the Crossover Podcast, SI Boxing with Chris Mannix, and Inside the Paint on SI TV. Man, the resume gets longer and longer. Chris, great job. Really appreciate you, and nice to have you back. Really appreciate it.
Anytime, Jim.
All right, so Gary Woodland is your 2019 U.S. Open champion. There may not be a better story anywhere. Seriously. Forget everything you know about his backstory for a moment, and I'll get there in a second. Focus on this. Gary Woodland is the U.S. Open champion. And going into yesterday, everybody knew the stat that Woodland was 0-7 when he had a 54-hole lead. So, obviously, the expectation was with the 2013 U.S. Open champ, Justin Rose, as his playing partner, and the major machine, Brooks Koepka, just ahead of them, somebody was going to run down Woodland. no way that Woodland could maintain that one-shot lead going into Sunday. I mean, a cool story to lead after Saturday, but Sunday is a different matter altogether. Sunday at the U.S. Open is where good stories get crushed. And Koepka looked like the guy who was going to wreck it. Birdie on 1, 3, 4, and 5. That's how you start a Sunday at the U.S. Open. That's how a two-time defending champ piles pressure on a guy who's never won one. Then Justin Rose also opened up with a birdie on 1 to tie Woodland. But then Gary responded, birdie on 2, birdie on 3. Like nerves? Yeah, I got your nerves. I got your nerves right here. But then a stretch. A bogey on 9, another on 12. Then you start to wonder, is the guy going to come unraveled? Is this where this happens? That moment that everybody's waiting on? Yeah, actually, not so. Then came the moment of the tournament, but not the one everybody was waiting on. The moment of the tournament for Woodland on 14.
Going at the front left bunker. Carried it. Carried it.
What a shot that is. 263 yards to the hole. That's a 255-yard carry uphill. And I got to tell you, it's cold out there.
Hey, man, again, 263 to the hole, 250-yard carry, and it was cold. 250-yard carry in cold conditions with a one-shot lead on the back nine of the U.S. Open at Pebble Beach on Sunday. I mean, absolute stones. There's brass, and then there's that shot. Quote, the idea was to play for the win. I could have laid up. That 3-wood separated me a little bit. End quote. And damn straight it did. You think he can't hang with the big dogs? Wrong. He can. Not only hang with them, but beat them back. That approach on 14 was iconic. I mean, that's not even hyperbole. Seriously iconic. That's the kind of shot, ionic. That's the kind of shot that goes down in U.S. Open lore. Pebble Beach lore. And incredibly, he had another one in him because he left himself in a bad spot on 17. How bad? This bad.
Sounded great. Oh, look at the shot.
Zing, we talked about off the tee how that was maybe the biggest swing and shot of his life.
I mean, that's incredible. That really is unreal. First the 3-1 on 14, then chipping on the green on 17. That's where he won the U.S. Open. Koepka missed a birdie putt on 18, but it didn't matter. Koepka did not choke that away. Woodland had a hold of it and would not let go. And if you needed any more proof of that or what this guy was all about, check the putt on 18.
Got it! A major champion, Gary Woodland.
That birdie took him to 13 under, one better than Tiger's 12 under back in 2000. That's how incredible this guy was over the 4 days. And if you couldn't tell from watching him all 4 days, I'm not sure how you could have watched and not realized that Gary Woodland is tough as hell. Legend has it that when he was back playing basketball in high school, he tried to draw a charge. He took a knee to the chest that resulted in a collapsed trachea. Doctors told him he'd be out for a few weeks. He played a few days later. A collapsed trachea on a Tuesday, and he's dropping 20-some points on a Friday. I mean, my guy's tough. But even Gary Woodland, basketball player, was no match for Kirk Heinrich. Because as the story goes, Woodland went to Washburn University on a basketball scholarship, got matched up with Captain Kirk in a game against Kansas, and that's when he knew his basketball career was effectively over.
I went to school to Washburn to play basketball, and I always believed if basketball didn't work out, I could fall back on golf. And our first game, we played, you know, Kansas at the University of Kansas. They were ranked number one in Division One. We were ranked number two in Division Two, and that decision got forced on me really quickly. I was guarding Kurt Heinrich, and like, okay, I need to find something else because this ain't gonna work. And that was my first game in college. You know, I was a two-time state champion, All-State, blah blah blah. But that was a different level.
Let me translate that for you. I got matched up with Kirk Heinrich. I took one look at this guy's haircut, and I'm like, oh, hell no. I'm out of here. Does this guy cut his hair with a four iron? Oh, hell no. I'm not playing basketball. Dude, it's a good thing you weren't matched up with Keith Van Horn. Anyway, there's so many other amazing Gary Woodland stories. You know, like the tragedy and joy his family has been through. Like the viral video from the Waste Management Open earlier this year with Amy Boccristetti. And the fact that he was FaceTiming with her and the trophy last night.
How are you? Did you like that today? Yeah. I used your positive energy. You were awesome. Thank you. You having fun?
Yes.
He's awesome. She's awesome. Like, I don't have time to play the entire video with Amy from the Waste Management Open, but if you have not seen it, you should. If you have seen it, you should watch it again. Gary Woodland is an absolute champion. This guy had Brooks Koepka, the two-time defending champ, the most dominant force in golf right now, bearing down on him, and he never blinked. Didn't blink, rose above it. He fought off Pebble. He fought off Brooks Koepka. He is your 2019 U.S. Open champ. Nothing but respect. Dude earned every damn last bit of it. It was awesome. One more awesome thing about it, too. One of the better U.S. Opens in recent memory for so many reasons. Not least of which that Gary Woodland went out there and he ripped it in the most clutch and brass way imaginable. Because he had every club, every shot working. But, do not sleep on the West Coast roll in this entire thing. How freaking awesome was it to watch a major played in the Pacific Standard Time Zone? How much better is it to get home from work and watch live golf instead of reading about it because everybody's done on Thursday and Friday before you are? You know, really? They should play just about every single golf tournament here, over here. I mean, this is sacrilegious. I can't go there. I was going to say, they ought to just pick up the Masters, dig it up, pick it up, bring it over here. Just drop it somewhere in the 909. There's a lot of room out there. A lot of unused land. A lot of smog, a lot of meth, but a lot of room out there. Now, you can't. Now, I take that back. I retract that. You cannot mess with the Masters. Leave it at Augusta. Augusta's absolutely perfect. I'm just saying, how nice was it that the leaders went off at 5:30 on the East Coast? Father's Day dinner and the U.S. Open taking you right to bedtime. You can't beat that. Tip your hat to the best coast because this week was just that much more awesome because of us. To quote Matt in L.A., you're welcome, world. And then there was the USGA. For the first time in forever, we can all say that the USGA did a nice job. That was a nice U.S. Open. Pebble looked great. Pebble played great. And for as gettable as it was on Thursday, the golf course did exactly what the USGA said it would do the next 3 days. It dried up, it firmed up, it sped up. You've heard me say it a million times. At O'Reilly Auto Parts, you'll get better parts, better prices every day. Listen, we'll have the parts you need to get the job done right. Stores are stocked with high-quality parts and accessories at guaranteed low prices. O'Reilly Auto Parts, better prices every day. O'Reilly Auto Parts. Gary Vaynerchuk is my guest. Gary, every time you and I talk, I've got to ask you, where in the world are you right now, and how are you doing?
Jim, I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. Thrilled to be with the jungle. Ironically, and this is crazy, I'm actually in the south of France at Cannes again, which we've done once before. I've literally never do anything here because it's the big marketing week. All the CMOs and CEOs of the biggest companies in the world are here. But obviously, with the timing of the baseball card and any time I can jam with you, I'm super fired up. Thanks for having me on.
No, I appreciate it. Great to have you on again. And that is pretty funny that you're back in Cannes. Now, you hit me up the other day with some really big, big news. And, of course, my immediate thought was, you did it. You pulled the trigger. You bought the New York Jets. You said that this is the most exciting thing that will ever happen to you, short of buying the Jets. It is a partnership with Topps Baseball Cards. Break this down for me. How did the conversation with Topps first come about?
So, you know, I know a lot of the jungle doesn't know who I am, but I'm an entrepreneur, and really I learned my craft during the 1986 to 1992 baseball card, sports card explosion. You know, the kind of kid that was making $3,000 a weekend at 13, 14, like real wild stuff, and really learned the game. So about 2 years ago, I started noticing cards were going back up. I've become completely infatuated with basketball as a global sport, soccer penetrating the U.S., And then just, you know, living life. You read an article here about, you know, a Tom Brady rookie card going for $50,000, this, that, the other thing. So I started digging in 18 months ago. Last summer, about a year ago, I really dug in, started buying a bunch of Akeem Olajuwon rookie cards, started buying a lot of Giannis rookie cards, which worked out because they 10X'd, and just started getting back in the game. My little guy turned 6. He started wanting to collect. And then I just started doing more and more homework, just like being early in Facebook and Twitter or e-commerce or a lot of things that worked for me. Basically, I'm very aware that unless the economy collapses, because the first thing that goes is sports cards, but if the economy stays in the general range, I'm predicting over the next 3 or 4 years that there's going to be a huge explosion in value in sports cards. So I start making content like I do on my podcast, videos on Facebook, showing pictures of me buying a ton of Luka rookies and Kareem rookies and LeBron rookies and Bill Russell 57 tops and all this stuff. It hits, obviously, some executives at Tops. They reach out and they said, how would you like to be an insert in our Tops baseball card next season? You have to understand, like, I was born, you know my story, we've become friendly, like, I was born in the Soviet Union, I'm an immigrant. Like, the thought, if you told the 15-year-old me that I was going to be in a baseball card, and for everybody listening, it's, I have a subset, 10 cards, Gary Vee's top entrepreneurs in baseball. So I did a ton of homework for about a month, which is unheard of for a bad student like me, which is why guys like Chris Iannetta, you know, Hunter Pence, Trevor May, along with Jeter and Bregman and Bryce Harper, Randy Johnson are in the subset. These are truly Marcus Stroman, who's an incredible entrepreneur. These are truly the top 10 entrepreneurs in baseball, 8 active, 2 retired. And what's been really crazy, I was literally just telling my friend Marcus before I went on with you, the Randy Johnson and me dual autograph, 1 of 5, there's only 5 of them, just sold last night on eBay for $2,000. So it's like the whole thing is wacky.
Gary Vaynerchuk, that's amazing. Now, you fast forward to today, and we've touched on this. I mean, you literally are in this game now. There's this awesome Instagram video of you ripping open packs and finding your card in there. Given what it was like when you were growing up, given you going to those card shows and what you took from them, what was it like to fire open that pack today and find your own card?
So first of all, I appreciate it. You saw it, right? Like,
yes.
You know my content. Like, do you see how genuinely, I'm laughing looking at that video. Like, I guess the one thing, you know, for all the sports fans that are listening, look, somewhere a long time ago, I realized I was more likely to, probably around 4th or 5th grade, I was more likely to own the Jets than to play for them. But all of us, we see these youngsters go into the league. I remember watching an interview with Jason Tatum talking about lining up against LeBron. We see those classic photos of, like, Tatum at 13 taking a photo of LeBron. I don't have the physical attributes to ever be on the field with my heroes that I grew up with, like those guys, but like, I can't explain what it felt like to open a pack of cards and randomly get a card that has my face on it. I genuinely don't know what to say. I'm super fired up about it.
Gary Vaynerchuk joining us. I know, V. I know it. It's great. It's a great, great video. Listen, before you go, you did tweet the other day, and we're off. Hashtag Lakers. What do you make of that Anthony Davis trade for L.A.?
I think it's a good trade for L.A. Anthony Davis is a top 5 to 7 guy in the league. LeBron's not a spring chicken. Let's not get crazy. Listen, I'm a ball fan. I think Zoe is going to be a good player, but it's not like he's destroyed the league in his first 2 seasons. I think it's more brand at this point than actually what he's doing on the court. You have to maximize LeBron's next 2 years. I thought it was a really good trade for the Lakers, you know, and obviously as a diehard Knicks fan, like, of course Durant and Clay are out for the year. Like, it's unbelievable what's happening to my New York Knicks.
Gary Vaynerchuk, it is so true. Now, what about, I follow you there, but I want to ask you about your Jets as well. Now, you are a diehard Jets fan. One day you plan to buy the Jets. We know this.
Yes.
What do you make, Gary, of where that team is right now?
It's always a good idea to fire somebody bad. And so for all the chaos that everybody thinks the Jets are under, fire McCagnan was the right call. I'm also unbelievably on the record. I mean, this is one of the biggest shows in the world. So I'm on the record. I'm very bullish on Gaze. I think he's a quarterback genius. A lot of my friends I debate with try to come with that baloney of it's just Peyton Manning. Kitna, Brock Osweiler, like Cutler, these guys had their best quarterback seasons with him. Darnold is learning a ton. I think the offensive line concerns me a little bit for this year, and the corners situation. But overall, the Gaze, like if Gaze wins 4 games a year for the next 3 years and gets fired, I'm on the record saying it was the right move for the Jets, because Sam Darnold, the core asset for the next decade and a half, is going to exponentially grow under this quarterback genius. Whether he's a head coach genius, obviously, much like Belichick or Pete Carroll, maybe his first rodeo didn't go the way he wanted to. That will play out. But there is no debating, if you're educated about the NFL, that Adam Gase is a quarterback genius. And when your core asset, much like the Lakers with LeBron, when your core asset is Sam Darnold going into year 2, it's a brilliant move. And listen, I have not been a fan of Mike Maccagnan. Over his draft history is ridiculously poor. He gave money to Mo Wilkerson and let Harrison Snacks walk. He's paid Revis. Like, he's just not done well. And so I'm happy they made that move, even though the timing is, you know, cliche Jets banter.
Gary Vaynerchuk has got a new deal with Tops. He is in the south of France. He's joining us right now. Gary, before you go, another entity that you're involved in is Green Street. It's a cannabis-focused branding and marketing agency. What was it about Green Street that excited you so much?
You know, so something that might make some people laugh if they're enjoying this interview is Stephen Ross, the owner of the Miami Dolphins, is the minority partner in my company, VaynerMedia. So, which has really made the whole Gase thing super fun to banter about. So because he's an NFL owner, VaynerMedia, my marketing company that works with Budweiser and Chase and all these great big brands, cannabis is going to be one of the biggest businesses in America over the next 20 years. I am an entrepreneur. I want to be winning in all those places. I thought it was more strategic not to put Steve in a precarious spot, because the NFL has obviously got really aggressive marijuana and cannabis rules, to start a separate company. So I teamed up with Rama and Josh, who had a company called Green Street. I came in to be a 49% partner. And we just had an incredible exit. We started a brand called Gas with 2 Chainz, the remarkably talented rapper, that we just sold off that company. And we're incubating brands. We're doing marketing for cannabis brands. It's a space I'm very fascinated by, because I think it's an incredibly big consumer space over the next 20 years.
So, Gary, where would a small investor go if they want to participate? If that's going to be that big of a brand or that big of a business, where would we invest?
That's a great question. That's a great question, Jim. I would say the answer is I don't know. And I love giving this answer, because I know my lane and I don't know. Like, being a small investor, there's a couple things that run through my mind. One, try to be in the shovels and picks business. You know, everybody went for the gold rush, but it was the people that sold shovels and picks that made most money, besides the few people that hit gold. So being a service provider or being in the ecosystem of cannabis CBD might be a good idea. So if you do PR and you're fascinated by cannabis, maybe you start a little cannabis PR specialty shop. So being a service provider would be really smart. Starting an influencer, you know, Facebook and Google do not take cannabis ads yet. And that's being worked out as the laws change in America. So starting an account that organically produces content and education around this might be a good idea, because these companies that have a lot of cash are looking for ways to spend on marketing where they can't put it into Google and Facebook, but they can put it into influencers or media companies. So that might be a good play. And then there's a bunch of publicly traded companies that I'm undereducated on, but if you like do your homework and you believe in them, it might be worth buying $1,000 worth of shares from that company if you think they're the, you know, the Peloton of that space, per se.
Gary V joining me from the south of France. Gary, before we go, I want to ask you about this. You've made the point that nobody should judge success on the 0.002% of their year. It's really interesting to me. Lay it out. What do you mean by that?
One more time, Jim. I apologize. On the point what?
That nobody should judge success on the 0.0002% of their year.
Yeah, I mean, this is just like, I'm so patient. Like, I'm the amount of L's, Jim, you know, look, the Toronto Raptors lost a lot of games this year in the scheme of things. And there was games that they, you know, I'm not educated enough to know their losses this year, but probably somewhere late in the season before the playoff run, they probably had a horrific loss to a subpar team. You can't, they ended up winning the NBA championship. And in that Sports Reference is how I think about everybody who's listening. Like, you might have really had a bad day at work today. Like, your boss might say you stink. I just think that everybody dwells and overanalyzes short-term things, a day, a week, even a month, and I'm going to really go there, even a bad year. Like, the reality is, hopefully, God willing, most people that are listening now with modern medicine, 90, 95, 100 years old. There's a lot of 42-year-olds, Jim, that are listening to your show right now that kind of think their life is set, that, like, not that it's over, but it's kind of like in its place. And I look at that guy or gal and say, you're going to live for 50 years. Like, don't just settle in. Just stop beating up yourself and stop judging yourself. Everybody else is doing it for you. You need to become your biggest internal champion and recognize how long life actually is.
He is a CEO of VaynerMedia and VaynerSports. He's the co-founder of Empathy Wines. He is a venture capitalist. He is the host of the Gary Vee Audio Experience. And now he's got some big, big news. He is in a partnership with Topps Baseball Cards, and you can find some entrepreneurs right there. Gary Vee, live in the south of France. Vee, you did it again. Gary, appreciate it so much. Great job.
Thanks, Jimmy. Wish you nothing but the best, bro.
So, welcome to Smack Off Week, the silver anniversary Smack Off. Smack Off 25. All the hype, all the buildup. It all leads to Friday, 4 days out and counting. Now, if you're not ready by now, that's on you. I don't know what else I could possibly have done. I've been setting the table every single day since we were 50 days out. The field is set. The players have been profiled. Tickets, golden tickets, have been given out and ripped back. I spent a lot of time laying out all the storylines. Is Brad going to do something that he's never done and go back to back and make it five titles and tie the all-time mark? Will the dude that he's chasing follow up on last year's cameo and make Brad go through him? I made it clear. We'd love to see the Cabo Nation pack in here. He is the all-time champ in terms of titles won. We'll see about that. Is Lef going to cement his legacy and become only the third caller ever to have three Smack-Off championships? Is Mike in Indy going to find a buyer for a spot on his call? Remember, Mike in Indy said, if there's somebody out there who's got the means and they want to experience a possible dream come true, for $5,001, I will put them on my call. Is Vic going to go vintage and get it done for the first time since 2010? Will the newly separated Canadians show up when it matters most? Is Rick going to rip the crown and bring it back to Buffalo? Or will a golden ticket winner like Jeff in Southfield or Dan in Denver rise up and shock the world? I could go on, but I'm not going to. I've already laid this out for everybody. It is officially go time because the week is here. So what I want to do instead is this. I've gotten this tweet and this email 1,000 times. Rome, how do I listen if my station does not carry the show? Rome, what do I do if my market preempts the Smack Off for a baseball game? Rome, I'm out of town on Friday. How do I find the show on the road? Look, I'm stoked that so many of you want to make sure the Smack Off is on Friday, or you know where to find it on Friday. That fires me up. Let's be real. It is 2019. It's time to be more intelligent than the guy who's programming AAA baseball on the 21st. Especially since it's that easy. But if for any reason you do not have the show on Friday on your standard radio dial, don't worry. You can stream the show live for free on jimrome.com. Or you can download the radio.com app for your phone. Again, the app is called radio.com. It sounds like a website. It's not. It's an app. Radio.com. Search for it in your app store on whatever kind of phone you have. It'll pop right up. Radio.com, not a website. It is an app. I know it's confusing, but it works. So you've got the JimRome.com website. You've got the Radio.com app. You also have SiriusXM channel 206. So if you've got SiriusXM in the car, we're on channel 206, not just Friday, but every single day. For TV, if you have DirecTV, the show is on channel 221. If you have Dish, we're on channel 158. Again, DirecTV 221, Dish 158. If you are a cable customer, just go to cbssportsnetwork.com. That's a website, not an app. cbssportsnetwork.com. At the very top of the homepage, you'll see a channel finder. It could not be any easier. Now, if you cannot catch the Smack Off live on any of these platforms on Friday, I will podcast the entire show afterwards. The podcast is called The Daily Jungle. You can find that on iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and the radio.com app. That's an app, not a website. It's everywhere. Now, everybody good? Good. Because we've got the radio stations, we have the app, we have the website, we have the TV simulcast, we have the satellite radio, we have the podcast all working. And best of all, that is not a Friday smack-off thing. That is an everyday thing. So, no more Rome. I can't find the show. Because I've got the show. I have the jungle everywhere right now. And if you can't find it, you're just not looking. You're not trying. Smack Off 25, this Friday, 4 days out. It has never been easier to listen to, live or on demand. Alvin, why don't you hit me with your amazing promo one more time?
I don't want to do this. I have to do this. This one is for America. USA!
Shut your punk mouth.
You sociopath.
Pitchy bitch with D-minus smack.
Gimmicky little snitch.
Look me up in the Stucknut take box. Check out my portfolio of dead bodies.
Smack Off 25. Friday, June 21. Remember, the only way to win is to get in.
I'm in the Smack Off and you ain't.
Crack me, Jim. I'll be there.
I mean, you people stink when you wash.
And the prize, $5,000 cash.
And a therapy dog.
This event is not for everybody. In fact, it's for the best of the best.
Bring the entire family circus because I got a clown suit for every last one of them.
We're talking about the upper 1,000.
None of them frighten me, but don't forget about Mona.
He needs to pull his pants up and do something productive in the world, like chew a box of razor blades so he would swallow his own fluids for a change.
Who wants to walk? The chef from Richmond.
Even if I did have flesh-eating disease, it wouldn't be that surprising. I'd want to eat me too.
When the other cheeses have a pot, American cheese sits home uninvited and eats a whole pack of itself from depression.
If I'm going to pay $100 to watch Bill Mickelson play golf, you damn well better be topless.
I'm Pedro Martinez, you're Don Zimmer, and you better get your decrepit fat ass back in the dugout.
Bro, it's a radio show. It's not Fight Club. Settle down, Junior.
From Redondo Beach to Rwanda, you're welcome.
From getting left back in the fourth grade to filing for bankruptcy for the fourth time.
Were you talking about concussions, or were you imitating that? I mean, Jim didn't know if you should cut the commercial or slide a credit card between your teeth so you didn't swallow your tongue.
Take out the gimmicks, and that call sucked so bad it might have sucked another Southwest passenger out of airplane window. Re-record that, bitch.
It is officially go time. Smack Off 25. 25 is a nice, fat, even number. I might walk off on that one.
Tell me how my ass tastes.
I want to talk about them flaming.
From Radio Wallpaper.
Larry Brown.
Larry Brown, really?
It's delicious.
Larry Brown, really? I don't know why. I always come out of that and reset that part of it. Although there are a million things I could reset. And it's not because it's at the end. It's just Jeff. It makes me laugh. Larry Brown, really? Alan Shipnook is my guest. Alan, good to have you back. How are you?
I'm doing well, Romy. How are you?
Good, bud. Good. Now, you were in the tap room at 1 a.m. this morning. Let me start right there. What was that scene like?
Well, it was great. You know, the tap room is the hub of the Pebble Beach Resorts generally. It's where all the golfers go to hang out during everyday play and certainly during the U.S. Open. This week, it was closed to the public. It was really off limits to reporters. But I used to work at Pebble Beach when I was in college as a cart boy, and I still know a few people. So my colleague Michael Bamberger and I sneaked in to have a late meal, and we're actually going to tape a podcast in there. But it was so loud and raucous. We got seated at a table right next to Jordan Spieth and Justin Thomas and their people. And not long after, Gary Woodland rolled in with the trophy and his entourage. And he's drinking out of the trophy. He's passing it around. Spieth is throwing spitballs across the room. Various Fox sports talent stopped by, guys like Brad Faxon and Joe Buck and some USGA officials. It was really kind of clubby and cool, and it was a great way to just kind of put a bow on the week. And it was interesting too to see Woodland in that environment. I mean, you could just see the tension come off of him. I think the drinks had something to do with it, but also the camaraderie with the other players. you know, of course, Spieth and Thomas have each won majors, and so they were welcoming him to the club, you know, very exclusive club in golf. So, yeah, it was a fun deal for sure.
That is really, really cool. Alan Shipnook is joining us. You know, before we talk about the details of the tournament itself, what is the experience of a U.S. Open at Pebble Beach like?
Well, it's, in some ways, it's the grandest stage in golf. We know about the beauty, and there's such a rich history there with the previous Opens. And there's, the holes are just so dramatic, the shots you're required to hit, the various questions that the course asks of the players. And there's an elegance and a stateliness to the surroundings with the lodge and where the putting green is tucked in right there. And everything about it just feels right, looks good, and you know, it's kind of a, it's a quintessential Open venue. The people here are hardcore golf fans because, of course, we get the Crosby Clam Bake every year. And so they know the players. There's a lot of relationships that have been formed through the years. You know, the, most of the players stay in private housing this week because they've broed up with Pebble Beach folks over time. I went out and played Cypress Point on Monday, and a bunch of the players are there hanging out. It's just, it's a special kind of week. It's a different feel. And partly because, you know, Pebble Beach belongs to all of us, right? It's a public venue. So many of the people in the crowd have played the course, and they have their little stories about the chip they had on the 17th hole. And you're not going to get that at Oakmont or Wingfoot or those ultra-exclusive venues. And so there's just a special feeling in the air all week long.
Alan Shipnook joining us. He's a senior writer for Golf Magazine, also a columnist for Golf.com. So, Alan, Brooks Koepka comes out on fire yesterday. He had birdies on four of the first five holes. When you saw him start like that, what did you expect the outcome would be like at the end of the day?
Yeah, it was hard not to have this feeling like, here we go again. I mean, Brooks has just become a monster, and he has created an aura that you can feel out there. The players, they know that when he's on the board, he's not gonna go anywhere. And he was, of course, the first seven holes of Pebble often are where you can do your scoring, but Brooks just was just playing spectacular golf, and he was strutting around like only he can. And you could see that Justin Rose was fighting a swing, and it was sort of predictable at some point it was going to betray him. Then it really came down to if Gary Woodland could hit the shots and hold his nerve, you know, with Brooks breathing down his neck. And those two guys are similar personalities, the similar builds. They play the game the same way, but you know, and Woodland comes into the final round 0-for-7 and closing out 54 hole leads on the PGA Tour. He just, the mental side of the game had escaped him to this point, and how to think his way around and how to stay cool under pressure and not to get those adrenaline surges that he had growing up playing basketball and baseball. And you know, Brooks has made an art form of all those things. He's just so relaxed out there and so comfortable. And So that was really the tension that was built into the back nine. What was Woodland going to crack? Because you knew Brooks wasn't. And ultimately, you know, Woodland hit the shots he needed to do. Brooks couldn't make a putt when he had to. And he was a very, you know, Gary Woodland was a very deserving champ. But, you know, all credit to Koepka. He just came strong, as he always does. I mean, it's three majors in a row that he was right there till the bitter end. And there's nothing to indicate that's not going to be the case for a very long time.
Alan Shipnook joining us. You know, Alan, just to finish that thought, and I appreciate the way you set that up, but you made the point before yesterday that it was kind of a mystery on tour as to why Woodland had only won three times. What was his reputation as both a player and a person?
Well, he's a beloved guy. He's a nice Midwestern boy who everyone likes, and just good people, you know. So people, he's easy to root for, and he's very popular on tour. Of course, a lot of people know now that 2 years ago he had a tragedy with his wife. She was pregnant with twins. One of them miscarried. The other was born very premature, but is now doing great. But, you know, it's a fraternity out there, and everyone kind of rallied around Woodland after that. And so it was a popular win in the locker room, in the caddy yard, and in the press tent. But as for why it took so long, I mean, that's the mystery of sports, right? Gary Woodland has all the tools. But he just hadn't quite figured it out yet. And he started working with a new swing coach, a guy named Pete Cowan. He's kind of the Euro Tour whisperer, and he's really helped Woodland upgrade his short game. And I think he just taught him a little bit about how to play the game and how to think his way around out there. And you could just see the comfort level that Woodland had the whole way through. And, of course, he hit the two shots of the tournament. There was that full-blooded three-wood on the 14th hole, 265 up the hill. I mean, there's only a handful of guys on tour who can hit that shot. I mean, that was a testament to his strength, but also his confidence. And that killer instinct you need to have to close the tournaments out. I think in the past he might have backed off and laid up and played for a C5, but in this case he went for it and he pulled it off. And then of course we saw that super delicate pitch on 17. That took a lot of nerve. It took a lot of technique. And he may have had the nerve before, but he didn't have the technique. And so you put his power with a better short game and a more reliable putting stroke. And then you mix in some self-belief, and it's a pretty potent combination.
Alan Shipnook, my guest. So what about that? When you take those three shots, right, you've got the 3-wood on 14, you've got the chip on 17, you've got the putt on 18. When you see those three shots and you see the way he closed out the U.S. Open, does that feel like something he can build on?
Oh, absolutely. It was important for the tournament as a whole, too, because it turned into a kind of a sleepy back nine where everyone was just hanging on. And You want a defining moment. You know, we had Nicklaus's one iron in 72 at Pebble Beach. We had Watson's chip in. We had Tom Kite's chip in on number 7. In 92, there's a long history on this great stage of players doing something really dramatic when it matters. And so it was nice that Woodland continued that. And you know, he has twins on the way again in August. And so his life is going to change in a big way. And you see this with a lot of guys when they win their first major championship, and all of a sudden there's money on the table for endorsements and to play around the world. And it's very easy to get distracted. You add in a couple, you know, how much that family life is going to change. I mean, let's hope that Gary Woodland can honor his gift. I mean, he has a chance to be a real force in this game. And he still lives in Kansas City. I mean, he's not a bright light, big city kind of dude. I think he'll do a good job of staying focused on what really matters. And you know, he's not a kid. He's 35. I mean, he doesn't have an endless future like a Justin Thomas or Jordan Spieth. I mean, he's got to make hay now. And so I think he will. I mean, I think he's going to be a force on the U.S. Ryder Cup team, and I think he'll be a consistent contender at these majors. And it's going to be fun to watch. I mean, he's just another strong American player like a Dustin Johnson, like a Brooks Koepka. And you throw him in the mix at these majors, it could be a lot of fun.
Alan Shipnook, my guest. Alan, one more topic before you go, and I appreciate the time. Then you have Phil Mickelson, right? And every time you get to a U.S. Open, there's that talk of him finally getting it, but he ended up in 52nd place. When you consider that he celebrated his 49th birthday yesterday, it would appear that time has run out on him, it would seem. If his career were to end without winning a U.S. Open, how much of that is a reflection of his game, and how much of that is a reflection of how much the USGA and the pressure of a U.S. Open got into his head, perhaps?
Yeah, I think it's more of the latter. I mean, Phil's one of the most talented players ever to peg it. And the fact that he's had six chances to win the Open, and it tells you, even with his reputation as being a little wild off the tee, he had the game to win it. But the U.S. Open is designed to push the players to the breaking point, you know, spiritually and mentally. And Phil snapped more than a few times. And he's not unlike Sam Snead, you know, one of the all-time great players who never won a U.S. Open. There's some guys who just don't have the fortitude. They don't have the ability to think clearly. They can't handle the stress of the Open. I mean, Phil's more of an Augusta National guy, right? He's freewheeling. It's this vast canvas where he can express his artistic side. That's not U.S. Open golf. I mean, it's an oppressive, claustrophobic test. And Phil's just failed it over and over. It's highlighted some of the problems with his ability to find the fairway. You know, you think about wing foot. In 06, he had two fairways on Sunday. It was a miracle he even had a chance to blow that in the last hole. You know, that was a technical breakdown. But there's been a lot of other times when he just lost his head, as they say. And it's always going to be part of Phil's legacy that he couldn't get it done. I mean, for a guy to have that much game, to be such a prolific winner, week in and week out, to win all the other majors, if he couldn't do it at our national championship, it tells you something about Phil. I mean, when all is said and done, he's going to be one of the most popular players ever. He's already in the Hall of Fame. He's got more money than God. I mean, no one's playing any violins for Phil Mickelson, but it's certainly going to be part of his enduring legacy that he couldn't get it done at the tournament that means the most to him.
I think you're right. That's fair. One last thought. Rory McIlroy came in, Alan, on a roll. He finished tied for ninth, which is a nice enough showing, but it could have been so much better. What do you make of his week?
Just the classic backdoor top 10 for Rory. I mean, right. He's the master at it in the majors the last 5 years. You know, most disappointing was he was on the fringe of contention. He had a chance to go out early, post a number, and put the pressure on the leaders, and just makes an awful double bogey on the second hole, and it's like you could just see all the air come out of Rory's U.S. Open week, and he went and made an, then he made a bunch of birdies in the middle of the round, and made another double bogey on the 16th hole. It's just, you know, Rory's won a U.S. Open, but that week at Congressional, I mean, it really played like a tour event. It was so soft and wet, and he could just smash driver, and there was no fire in the golf course, and it still counts. I'm not taking away from it, but it was a different kind of test, which he passed. And in general, there's a lot of feel in Rory. He's just a freewheeling momentum player. And, you know, we've seen him shoot 61 to win some tournaments on Sunday. When he gets it going, it's awe-inspiring. But that's not U.S. Open golf, where you just have to grind it out and you're fighting for par and you have to leave the driver in their bag a lot of times, which certainly takes away some of Rory's advantage. And so it was a bummer because all year long, Rory's been playing at an extremely high level. If you look at all the stats, he's near the top and most of the important ones. And, of course, he's won twice. And right now he's in the conversation for Player of the Year, but he just can't quite get it done at the majors, and that the reason they're so revered as tests is because they're the most exacting, they're the toughest to win, and they point out the holes in players' games. And right now, Rory is just struggling with a few things when it really matters.
He is a senior writer for Golf Magazine, a columnist for Golf.com, the author of 6 books, and that is a great conversation. Alan Shipnook, and he was in the tap room at 1 o'clock in the morning. Alan, great job, man. Appreciate you. That was fun. Really good job.
All right. Thanks for having me. See you, Jim.
Slash in Brentwood. Hey, Slash, what's up?
Hey, Snags, good show, dude.
Thanks, Slash.
Been a while since we last spoke, right?
Yeah, it has.
And I know. And the more things change, the more they stay the same. Alvy keeps adding to his army of children. Hawk is Hawk. And Drew in West LA is still a bag. But obviously, Mr. Rome, the reason I'm calling today is to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the famed White Bronco chase down the interstate. And, I mean, here we are, 25 years later, most high-profile case in United States history. Innocent verdict, may I add. But now the juice is ringing the bell for all the wrongdoing and lambasting he's been taking on Twitter. And, you know, it just happens to be 25 years since the first smack-off. So, could you imagine back then OJ addressing how he's got a lot of people to get even with in 1994? Or, you know, the elephant in the room, how he never wrestled with Chris Jenner. But anyways, Jim, congrats on the silver anniversary. I know there's a golden ticket sitting there, just like a pair of prescription glasses at Mezzaluna. And I'm here today to rip that ticket. Just like I ripped open the necks of Nicole and her boy toy Ron, I'm out.
That's not a good call. No. You don't like that call.
I don't like that call. Not a very good call.
Good night now!